introduce myself. First of all, my name is Yiska Weldman. There's no more elastics left, so my tag is in a rather weird place. So you'll forgive me. I'm excited to be here. I wanted to talk a little bit today about truth or wisdom, what we get from the other. And I'm pretty sure, if you're like me and you love literature and you, I don't know, maybe you like a good movie, maybe if you have little kids, you're stuck watching some less good movies or some less enjoyable TV shows. What I have found is that actually the more I think about this motif, this trope of learning from the other, the more you can find it in literature and the more you start paying attention to that as a type, right? So let's think about that for a second. I want to just brainstorm about where we see this notion of learning from the other itself. I gave you some examples on the top here, but maybe you have your own that come to mind, some favorite children's books, some...
Footloose.
It's interesting. So, guy comes out from outside the town. It's really funny. It's a good one. I like it. Yeah. What else? Footloose. I'm not going to dance for you. That would be bad. What do you got? Yeah. Can you think of anything?
Something with Disney cartoons.
Yeah. Well, you could argue a genie from... he's not that wise, though. I don't know. He's iffy wise. The idea here is that, for some reason, occasionally, in literature, where the main characters, and whoever they represent, can't learn from themselves, they have to, somehow, wisdom has to come from someone else. And in and of itself, you think, well, that's actually fairly reasonable. Like, I don't know, give me the obvious answer. Why might it be that it's something that you'd want to learn from outside?
They've had the experience in there.
They have a different perspective, they've got different experiences, right? That's sort of the logical assumption. Does that make sense? Does anybody have anything else?
Does Yoda count?
Yeah, I thought about Yoda. Yeah. I was thinking about Yoda, and then I wasn't sure.
You have to go somewhere far away.
But then I was like, I'm sorry, forgive me, I'm not that good and that fluent in Star Warsies, if that's the term, which it is not. But I was thinking Yoda is one of like many different people. But then I was thinking actually most of the people who are the heroes are, of course, the regular, you know, white guys. Right? So, and they're not little green men. So it's a hard call. Yeah, I think it's an interesting thing. Okay, well, maybe you'll start thinking about it. I'll give you some examples that I have here. Let's look at the other examples first. The Delphic oracles, right? The idea that people would go and learn wisdom or truth from these... they were women, right?
Yeah.
Right? From these women who could somehow foresee the future and tell actual truth to people. I'll talk about Pocahontas in a second. In movies, I cleaned up that. Usually this is called the magical Negro trope.
Yeah.
Actually, the more you find that one, you'll find that in like every TV show. It's actually quite absurd. And every movie.
Always Morgan Freeman.
And it's always Morgan Freeman. Actually, if you Google Magical Negro, you will get Morgan Freeman in, like, I think it's 5 different movies. A lot of which I have not seen, but Legend of Bagger Vance is the most obvious.
That's Will Smith.
Just kidding. You're right. But he actually plays...
He's
that weird one in the Evan Almighty and the other one. And also... You could argue Driving Miss Daisy, but you'd have to sort of think about it. There's a few others with Morgan Freeman in it. But yes, okay, and in addition, Legend of Bagger Vance with Will Smith is an interesting character where he gives wisdom to this golf pro, if you haven't seen it. I had actually not seen it. I'd seen clips. And of course, there's wisdom from animals. Who could be more other than, you know, someone who's not actually human? And I'm guessing that that actually is the example you probably could think of a few. From children's literature, just a few. I was thinking of Winnie the Pooh is sort of an obvious one. The Lion, Witch, and the Wardrobe. The lion. Yes, but before he's Jesus, he's an animal. Before you get past that metaphor, he's still an animal. Yes, Jesus is the ultimate source. But, right. Okay, so but the idea is that there are always these others that come to teach us wisdom. Why? What's interesting about those characters? I mean, why is it that we're going to be learning from them? It can't just be perspective. What's unique about these individuals? these creatures, these Yodas. Would you say Yoda? I don't know if you right? I mean, what's interesting about them, yeah?
Well, really, you have, because they are so distinct, it's not just a ring, but they are others, and therefore, like, it makes their knowledge seem more esoteric and therefore more powerful.
Yeah, more powerful. Here's the problem that I've been having recently, though. For whom are they powerful? This is the thing that's been interesting to me. Right? If you think back to, like, the magical Negro trope, right? They're not actually helpful for themselves.
No.
Right? Who are they helping?
The one who listens.
Well, yeah. Like, always, they're usually resistant to that listening in the first anyway, right?
But they
certainly listen to themselves, so why are they not able to get themselves out of...
The
privileged person. It's always this way. Right? And the more you think about it, the more you realize that that's actually what's happening. Almost always, what you have is the mainstream group, which in a lot of cases, not every single case, and certainly not the cases, all the cases I'm giving you today, but what you have is this notion that the other comes to teach wisdom to the person who is, well, the mainstream, the good guys. You know, the good guys are just, they need a little help, right? And if they are in a less privileged stance, they actually don't get themselves out of that less privileged stance. But they exist for the purpose of righting or bettering the individuals who are they're supposed to be in that position, right? So Legend of Bagger Vance would be an example, right? So he helps this, you know, privileged white man become a better golfer, right? And sort of reclaim his career. You understand? And I think that's a really interesting notion that it's not just that the other provides wisdom, because, well, another can always provide that. There's actually sources right here in the front. The other can always provide wisdom, but in theory, if they're in a place where they're actually, you know, in need themselves, you'd think they would better themselves, but that's not what the motif is. The motif is bettering those who are, you know, already in the privileged position.
They also end up either dying or leaving.
I mean,
if they're a Christ figure,
Mary Poppins.
Right. There's some kind of, you know, aspect of voyager, and they continue on to go help somebody else.
Yes. Very good. Because wisdom has to, like, you need to spread wisdom in a sense. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think there are different categories. There's, like, the ostracized other, that's, like, completely, you know, like, generally, most people will learn from them, you know, except, like, the privileged few who either seek it out or break through some kind of barrier.
Good, yeah.
And then there's the other one that's, like, what you're describing, like, Yitro or Mary Poppins, who are in a privileged position. Or they're still outside of the community, but they're not ostracized.
Yes.
They just have, like, a malach, like they have a role to play.
Right, so the ostracized, you're right. So we have to be a little bit careful. I mean, they are sort of ostracized in certain communities. I mean, Yitro is still not one of us. From our perspective, Yitro is not us. Right? And, of course, from the Midrashic perspective, Yitro kind of wants to be one of us, but can't. Right? And he's still very other. I mean, you're right. It's not as egregious, let's say, as, you know, sort of a different class. But it is kind of an interesting thing. The other biblical examples, by the way, Judah and Tamar. Of course, Tamar, you have to argue, was certainly reviled. And then she is the one who actually teaches Judah what he should have done all along, but he didn't do. He chose not to do for whatever reason. Miriam, whom we're going to talk about, actually, is a complicated case. Easier to see in the Midrash, I'd say, than actually in the Pshat of a biblical text. And Moshe, whom we're going to talk about also. But, yeah.
Just in thinking about what this does for the other, I think we do have several examples of situations where the other is redeemed in the process of redeeming the one who used the other. So whether it's E.T. or the Green Mile, you know, there's a measure of self-recognition in the other as well.
The Green Mile is the one that also comes up. So what happens in the Green Mile? I mean, he dies, no?
He does die, but he's carrying a guilt with him that he suffers from until he's able to admit to the fact that this is what happened.
I got it.
The story.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
So the minute he can tell the story, he's now released himself.
Yeah, that's very interesting. But his wisdom also really is for Tom Hanks, though, also, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so it's a little bit of both.
I think there is a little bit of both. I think that when we see the other, it's safe to see ourselves Is it safe to see someone else in the predicament that we're in ourselves, but we don't want to face it?
Right, yeah.
And when the other experiences the redemption, it permits us to experience a redemption as well.
Very good, very good. I like that. I'm not sure that's the more common, but I do think it's interesting. Okay, so let's see. Well, let's see if that's true for any of the sources that we brought here. I do want to draw your attention to the last page, where I talked about this other thing called Bassanos, which I'm guessing most of you have not heard of, because it's not all that common a topic. On the very bottom of the page, you'll see that there's a test called Bassanos, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it correctly, in ancient Athens, where in order to get testimony from like a free man, they used to beat the slave. And that in and of itself is very bizarre, if you think about it. The idea is that the individual who is the free man isn't able, you're not allowed to torture them, but you are allowed to torture the slave. You are, he's a slave. And it's, you can either argue, well, he's sort of an extension of the person, but he's actually not just an extension. He's an extension that is permitted. He is other. He's outside the body of the other individual. And for some reason, truth, meaning full, like honest testimony, will come from that individual. Right? It's a very strange notion. It's a very strange and, I assume, at least for me, certainly problematic notion about where truth comes from and what does it really even mean. In addition, you know, just as a side note for that piece, is the idea is that slaves are without reason normally. So that means that there's a sort of a side assumption that if you were to try and elicit testimony from the individual who wasn't allowed to be beaten, you're not going to get truth from that person. But you can get truth from the person that you are allowed to beat, in this instance, the other, meaning the actual slave. Yeah.
Well, this Bassanos actually raises the issue of secrets.
Yeah.
Because the slave may possess his master's secrets, uh-huh. And there's some idea that wisdom is secret.
Yes.
And that's a broader topic.
Absolutely, absolutely. Right.
The Torah is like the exception.
Right.
It's not so.
Okay, so let's take a look at the texts that we have. So I began with, some of these are very famous few, but I'm not sure whether you have actually looked at them in the framework with the lens of learning from the other or not. This one you probably have, because it's a fairly well-known one. Is there somebody who wants to read? I'm pretty open if you feel like doing Aramaic or if you feel like doing English. Surprise me. Yeah.
On the day when the rabbi died, the rabbi decreed a public fast and offered prayers to heavenly mercy. They furthermore announced that whoever said that Rabbi was dead would be stabbed with a sword.
Okay, let's stop there. You're familiar with this story? I personally just love the first line. So it turns out before he dies, right, the rabbis make a fast and they're praying for mercy to hope that he will not die, actually. And they're afraid that actually he will die. And they said that whoever is the first one to announce it, you're going to get stabbed. Turns out that's kind of something that dissuades people from announcing information. you should learn that for your, you know, jobs and shoals and stuff. So don't threaten people with a sword. So that's a very interesting thing and relevant to the end of it. Go ahead.
Rabbi's handmaid ascended to the roof and prayed. The immortals desire Rabbi to join them. And mortals desire Rabbi to remain with them. May be the will of God, mortals may overpower the immortals. When, however, Sasaha often he resorted to the privy, painfully taking off his fill and putting them on again. She prayed, may be the will of the Almighty, the immortals may overpower the mortals.
Okay, stop there. All right, so basically, what does this handmaid do? Also, there's a if you don't have, we have sheets in the front. Oh, you have, okay, no.
She sees his pain.
She sees his pain.
And his suffering, and she cares about him and wants to help him move on, move forward.
Move forward. She wants to take him out of his suffering. This source has probably been used by almost all of you at some point, usually used in conversation about obviously, euthanasia. But in addition, and you might have already talked about the fact that it's extremely unusual that the actual wisdom and the fact that actually it actually happens, that she actually enacts it, she facilitates his freedom, which we haven't gotten to yet, happens at the hands of a simple handmaid, right? A simple servant, really. In and of itself is very interesting. I also like that the interesting part is the first part, because you can imagine that she's probably pretty close with him in some way. I mean, we already know that Rabbi likes his servants. in general, and maybe they like him too. Right? So.
But there's also something fascinating about it's not the fact that he's just involved in pain, it's not going to the privy often that moves her so. It's the faithful expression that he needs to, you know, undertake, take off its film, and then go to the privy and then put it back on when he comes out.
His determination.
His determination, sort of, in a sense, her thinking there's just a faith and piety.
Yeah.
And she has to relieve him.
Very interesting.
The burden of his pride.
Yes, yes, yes. I think a lot of us, I think those of us who have had, you know, people in our lives who were in a situation like that, we can sort of speak to that, right? I mean, sometimes at the end of people's lives, if they really want to, you know, like say, walk or get up or do whatever it is that they used to do, whatever the situation was, and there is just this, they can't let go, right? And so I think that's a nice point. I agree. So, okay, but I also think it's very interesting that in the very beginning, she actually tries to pray with, it's not that she came in just to intercede on behalf of the rabbis who were keeping him alive. Her first move is actually to pray also, which I think is very interesting. Very, very few people actually think about that. But I think it's actually really interesting. I mean, she wants to be with them. She wants to be one of the people that actually prays for mercy on behalf of Rabbi. I mean, I think that's actually kind of nice. Right, but then exactly as you say, I think right that she sees his pain. She sees, you know, that he can't let go, and she wants to stop it. And she prays first before she actually takes action. She prays first to see if maybe God will then, you know, listen to her prayer first and sort of stop the madness. She changes her prayer. She flips it onto.
Which is. In a novelistic sense, what the hero does, right? The hero in the novel changes.
Very good. Yeah.
And that's, I mean, that's remarkable that she completely shifts.
She learns. Genius. She learns. Good. Okay, let's take this home.
As rabbis incessantly continued their prayers for heavenly mercy, she took up a jar and threw it down from the roof to the ground. For a moment, they ceased praying, and the soul of Rabbi departed to its eternal rest.
Some of you are this way too when I read a midrash. I love these moments. These, you know, the jar falls from, you know, the roof to the ground. And there's this, you know, and there's like this moment, this like breath taken away. And at that moment, that's when Rebbe is free. That's when he can die. Right? And I think they, maybe it's just me, the way I read it, you know. But I think they really, they put it so well. It's so terse and so short. Right? But I hear it. Like, I hear it. Right? He crashes to the ground, and he's able to die.
It's almost as if, like, when the vessel breaks, the soul is allowed to be.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
It's also recognition his body as the vessel is broken. I think the vessel is the metaphor for his body. You can't see that his body is broken, and that's when, you know, the breath is taken out of it. So it's not just that you're sort of taken aback, you know,
right?
You hold your breath when you hear this shocking sound. It's that his body is broken. His breath is gone.
Yes.
So it's just it.
And your point.
It's sympathetic magic.
Right.
This happens and that happens because this represents him.
Your earlier point, I think, is even, you know, driven home more, because it reminds me about the rabbis who are so unable to let him be and recognize that he is broken and recognize that maybe his piety has gone too far and they are overkilling with their own, that they are going to kill anybody who even says that he's dead, even after he's already dead, right? I mean, just to say it, like to admit it, to get to that point, right? They will kill you, which is... Right.
Well, so why do they threaten that?
Yeah.
It's because they believe in the power of prayer in ways that are not really understandable to us. It works. And you have to stop the prayer, because as long as we're still davening, it works. And,
yes, yes.
And we do that. We don't quite get it.
Right.
We want to finish up as soon as possible. Right. We need to go as slow as possible. Wasn't just magic, but it was divine intervention there.
Right. And this is also a motif, by the way, throughout the rabbis, one of which I actually have another copy of here, another example of here, but also the famous one of King David, praying until the Malcham Avid can actually get him. You know, he knocked, whatever it was, he knocks at the door and distracts him in some way. So that's kind of an interesting thing. Okay, so all right, let's see what happens with this, the sword situation.
Go to the rabbis of Bar Kappara and investigate. He went, and finding that Rabbi was dead, he tore his cloak and turned the tear backwards. On returning to the rabbis, he began, "The angels and the mortals have taken hold of the holy ark. The angels overpowered the mortals, and the holy ark has been captured." "As he," they asked him, "gone to his eternal rest?" "You," he replied, "said it. I did not say it." Don't stab me!
I love it. So he finds out, he sees that he's dead, he rips his clothing as is appropriate, and he finds out that his Rebbe has died, but then he covers it over, like he turns it backwards so no one knows, because he doesn't want to get in trouble for even ripping, because I'm sure that's probably also, that's at least worth a whipping, evidently, in the context of this. And then he does the saying and says, the same idea, right, the angels versus the mortals, right, it's the same thing as the prayer above, that the angels and mortals were fighting over this thing, but it turns out that the angels have won. The holy ark, meaning Rabbi, he's the holy ark, has been captured, which is such an interesting image by itself. And they say, wait, has he died? And I said, you said it, I'd say it. What? What are you talking about? I don't know what you're talking about.
If that's what you think, then I guess so.
You have to stab yourself then, huh? And that's how they do it, which is, I think, a very interesting end to it. At any rate, in terms of learning from the other, obviously, in this instance, it's actually very unusual. What happened to the learning from the other in this particular situation? Why is this an unusual example? Let's put it that way.
She fades back to the background.
You don't even know she's there. The only person who knows she's there is her. Hmm. Maybe Rabbi, or maybe the angels, or I don't know.
The reader.
What?
The reader,
well, yes. But the rabbis do not. They do not know. Right? And that's, I think, a very interesting piece. So she's not somebody who's out for glory. She's really out for mercy. Right? Which makes her, I think, an additionally interesting character. Also, if you probably look into that learning from the other thing in literature and stuff, you'll also learn, the people who actually, they always have this, noble cause kind of individual, like the person who did it just for nobility and not for fame. Yeah.
Also, because you talked earlier about how, in the classic kind of thing, that generally the other is a servant, and because I'm a good kind of gut man, because I watch all the specials about it, and the proper kind of servant, you don't notice them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They live for the sake of the people that they're serving,
right.
And they're supposed to live in that.
That's how my servants are. I barely notice them at all.
Yeah.
As if they're not there. Yeah.
Yeah. Those servants are really bad, I think.
That's right. Yeah.
I keep ringing and ringing, and nothing happens.
There's been a lot of, whenever I study this, it's been a lot of discussion of her being on the roof.
Yes.
And I'm just thinking about that again in terms of this question. And she's, obviously, she's socially beneath all of these people, but she is physically higher. She's between the mortals and
she is in between.
Angels.
I think that's right. Her prayer is higher. It's a physical.
But she's also overhearing. She's kind of outside of the space.
I think they're actually outside. Also. Don't you think? I mean, he's sick. He's dying. They're not, inside the room. They're outside the room, holding court.
And she's in a particularly precarious place.
Yes.
Because it's a roof. I mean, she could fall off.
Well, we've got the railing. It's illegal. You're telling me that Robbie doesn't have that law. Come on.
No, I agree. So, yeah. Probably a flat roof, too.
It's a flat roof.
It has a railing,
for sure.
Maybe he's lying on it.
I got it.
I don't know if this is a motif throughout, but the outsider is in reality and mainstreams in denial.
Yes. Right. Right. Which actually makes sense, because they are the ones that are denying the truth so much so that they're willing to kill others for truth. Right? And she's the one who is trying to take mercy and sort of see what really needs to be done.
Well, I think this is actually good. Aaron has a whole bunch of stuff on the terms. I don't know if he's like this.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah. But he said, it's like Gloria Shalom, I don't remember if he says this. But the person has to be an outsider.
Yes.
Because of their their understanding that sometimes wisdom comes from the source of the inability to admit somebody as an equal. So that's why she disappears.
Right.
They understand in a certain way that they're her wisdom is superior to their, right. They can never really...
That's a perfect segue, so thank you. Right? So great segue. Because here...
Circle Lone Ranger.
What's that? Circle I was thinking Lone Ranger too, Tonto.
Who was that? Dr. Robert? Who
no,
was
but I was thinking Tonto serves the role.
Who was that masked man?
Right.
The Incredible Hulk. Like in the series, for, I guess.
I remember. Like, believe me.
Right. Well, so he would go help somebody. He had his own, right? And then he'd move on. He'd go somewhere else.
Right, but does he learn? Who's the other there? The Hulk?
Yeah.
He's the other, even to David Banner, or no?
Bruce Banner.
Bruce Banner, I always do that. I actually knew somebody named David Banner, I always did that. Yeah.
Who was the other? But he was always the other to wherever he was going.
Yeah, it's good.
I mean, that's the thing about the others. They're always a threat. And the exact threat...
Wolverine's this way, too, by the way.
Yeah.
Wolverine, all these things for my 4-year-old.
Always comes true.
That's good.
Right? The stranger that comes into town, everybody's afraid of him because he's got these crazy new ideas, and it may change them.
Right.
And it ends up changing the exact threat they thought was going to happen.
Oh, yeah. So now we're on every Western in the world, right? Right.
Yeah.
Good.
Provincial. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what are you doing? What do you do with the fact that the rabbis don't
learn? Right.
They haven't learned anything in this story.
Nope. Well, no, they haven't learned anything. However, Bar Kappara did. Bar Kappara learned how to tell people truth in a way they could handle it. We could actually learn a little diplomacy from that dude. Right? I mean, because in a sense...
But in terms of from the other, what's the lesson?
From the other, we don't necessarily learn wisdom, but the wisdom there exists nonetheless. It doesn't matter, right? The wisdom is in the wisdom is for the reader, right? Okay. The idea that we are, we have to at least let go sometimes.
So the author
right?
of the narrative is teaching us the reader.
They are
not showing an example of that.
Correct. And so actually, that's why I said that was such a good segue, because I think it's actually really interesting that in truth, actually, the rabbis don't necessarily know that they're actually receiving this wisdom from the other, and that's actually kind of an interesting thing. But in some of the others, you're going to see that they do, actually. They're consciously accepting the wisdom along the lines of Bagger-Vance and some of the other examples that we talked about, where they actually have to overcome those barriers, as you said, right, in order to accept and receive that wisdom. So you're right. I think this one is different. One of them two, yeah.
Also women rabbis. Definitely the other. Absolutely. I recall this place 40 years ago. And it's something very quite there are elements of this story which fit into this whole saga.
Right.
Outsiders are where you are and doing different things which the other people which the people there don't understand, have no appreciation of, they're threatened by.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Also just thinking of the when we're in a pastoral role, having to tell some very bad news to people, there is often a rage that is barely beneath the surface from those people. That's equivalent to this, I'll fill you with a sword. And the joke at the end, you said it, I didn't. I mean, it's funny.
It came from you.
But it's also actually great pastoral wisdom,
yes.
Because my job as a pastor is to get you to say it.
Right.
Rather than
having
me tell it to you.
Good. I like that. Okay, so because we're going to be short on time, so the I'll just let you know about the Antoninus part because after this, it's not so crucial, but Antoninus, of course, what is he, back at this point, I don't remember, he's a Roman governor, or if he's the emperor at this point. It's just interesting because he's talking also to Ravi, and he knows two things that Ravi doesn't know. And Ravi actually accepts it. Of course, in this particular instance, he accepts both of them, but he says, and also it's supported from Torah. Right? So it's okay for him to accept the wisdom of the other because he himself was able to derive it as well from the biblical sources. Which I think is an interesting thing, too. Okay. The next one here on the next page where it says Baba Matiah 59b. You know the story. You've taught the story. Hopefully you love the story. Occasionally you make fun of the story of Tanur Shalach Nai. This is the end piece. It's actually my favorite part of the piece, by the way.
Yes.
So, FYI. I don't know about you guys. But this is the very last bit where we have Ima Shalom. If you know anything about Ima Shalom, who is she? What's that again? Raman Gamliel's sister, married to, right? So she marries Rabbi Eliezer, and what that means is, number one, she comes from a in a sense, a royal family, right? Which actually gave her access to a certain kind of knowledge. For whatever reason, she had access where other people do not. She's other for a whole host of reasons, if you think about it. She's other because she's a woman, yes. She's other because she's a woman who has knowledge. She's other because she's a woman who has knowledge who doesn't usually get to share it. And that makes her, I think, an interesting character for our purposes as well. So, is there somebody who wants to read this piece? We're at the top of the second page.
Ina Shalom of Mariah's wife, and this is Israel and Raphael. From the time of his infant onwards, she did not permit him to fall upon his face. Now a certain day happened to be new moon, but she mistook a full month for a defective one. Others say a poor man came and stood at the door, and she took out some bread to him. On her return, she found him fallen on his face. Arise, she cried out to him. You have slain my brother. In the meanwhile, an announcement was made from the house of Rabban Gamliel that he had died. From where do you know it? He questioned her. I have this tradition from my father's house. All gates are locked, excepting the gates of wounded feeling.
Okay, so if you're familiar with the story, if you recall, there's a whole back and forth in the story all along about the rabbis versus Rabbi Eliezer, who was unwilling to back down from his opinion on this particular oven. And it doesn't end, whereas some people end it, I have no idea why. They end it at Itzchuni Banai Itzchuni, which means, you know, my sons have defeated me. Yay, conservative Judaism. However, in context, yes, yay. And I think actually even throughout you could argue the rabbis win in this sort of majority has to rule because we have to function as a law-creating community. And I think that you could argue that even after when Gamliel is on the ship, you guys remember Gamliel's on the ship and a wave comes to drown him, and then he argues back at God saying, listen, I didn't do it for me, I did it for, you know, you. I'm trying to reduce strife in Israel. And, you know, some people want to say, see, you know, he fought back, or God's still mad, or however you want to see it. I think the bottom line is there's got to be something else going on that's making God annoyed enough to try and kill Gamliel over and over again. And I think the key to that is actually this last piece, which is, of course, Ona'ah. And that is, the fact of the matter is, Gamliel and his crew, or his posse, may be correct that Eliezer has to back down, and that maybe God has no miracles, we'll say, don't have a place in a kind of a rational Sanhedrin situation. However, there's a way to go about it. And if you recall, what did they do to Rabbi Eliezer even before they excommunicated him? Do you guys remember the story?
They make him break all the... He brings everything in front of them, and they...
They burn everything he ever said was pure, which seems so gratuitous and so damaging to the community itself. Even worse, right? I mean, there is the damaging nature and the ripple effect of the damaging effect of this is really overwhelming, actually. I mean, I think that's actually what's happening here in this text, which you really don't see if you ended it in Squinty Banai. You really don't see even if you ended after the ship with Gamliel. I really think you actually need this piece to understand what's really at play. The thing that's happening here is the reason that Gamliel dies, right? Gamliel dies because, yeah, you committed Ona'ah. And God's got Eliezer back. Like, you shouldn't have done that. That was a bad move. So I think what's happening is, Gamliel, you were right, but you're also a bully. You did the wrong thing. And who is it that actually has to explain what happened? Because even Eliezer doesn't know it. He's not conscious. This is an arguable thing. I know it's controversial what I'm about to say. It's not like big controversial. It's mini controversial. What I'm going to say, and that is, I don't think Eliezer knows what he's doing. Eliezer's just praying. He's doing tachanun. He's praying intently. He's upset. He was excommunicated. He was embarrassed publicly. He lost his community. He's in pain. And God feels that pain. When he says tachanun, who knows it? Not even Eliezer. Not even Eliezer knows it. He doesn't know that truth. It's his wife. Who didn't bother, by the way, to tell him beforehand, possibly because he wouldn't have listened. Right? When is it that he actually finally asks? She says, she sees him doing tachanun after she is distracted, either by the fact that she got confused, when was Rosh Chodesh, when was not, and whether he was actually supposed to do tachanun or not.
Or, arguably, you know, there's a noble cause if she was feeding the poor person at the door, which is also a motif in various places.
So either she's not a good rabbi, or she's an especially kind.
She's especially kind. She's just a woman. It's okay.
She's just a woman.
right? But it's really, it's so shocking to Eliezer that she knew it. I mean, do you hear it in the voice? How did you know that? Like, why did you know that? He's flipped out. Not just that evidently he killed Eliezer in some weird, I personally think somewhat indirect manner, but that she knew it before he did. Why did you know that? And she says, because I learned from my father's house. All gates are locked except for Onaah. God will hear. God will listen. All the gates are locked now. Temple's destroyed. Right? But God will listen when people are wronged. And you spoke to God because my brother wronged you. He killed my brother.
So why didn't her brother know this teaching from her father?
What are you asking? Why do bullies bully? How about I answer that question? I don't know why, but I think, you know, you could argue heat of the moment. That is such a heated argument. It's extremely emotional altogether, and you can see they're all so extreme. Why did Eliezer try to kill him in the baby and the baby drash? It's not like he was rational. It's not like he's awesome. And he won't back down, which is also not that rational, right? In and of itself, I can sort of see it. But the most interesting thing to me is, of course, now, you might argue Ima Shalom is not other because she is really of the royalty of the community. But I think, right, by virtue of the fact that she is a woman, and it was such an unexpected, even her own husband, who should have known how wise she was, right, and what kind of information she may actually carry with her from whatever generation, even he's surprised, which I think is very interesting. Yeah.
So I'm having difficulty with this reading.
Yeah.
Probably because the lack of, you know, of the pronoun gave it, but so she's trying to keep her husband from falling on his face.
Correct.
But then it's Rabbi Gamaliel who dies.
Correct.
How do we know it's not Rabbi Eliezer who dies?
Because he's speaking at the end.
It says an announcement was made from the house of Rabbi, and we know that Rabbi Eliezer.
Why would an announcement come from Rabbi Gamaliel's house that Eliezer died, who's standing right next to Ima Shalom?
Part of the house because he married in. I don't know. I mean,
it's not. The announcement comes from Rabbi Gamaliel's house that Gamaliel has died because they're the ones who are the first to know it. They have the shofarot or whatever it is that announced that he is gone. As soon as the shofarot gone, my assumption is that Gamaliel either was sick, and so it's not shocking, but whatever it is, some announcement in some way, I'm not there, so I don't know.
Right.
An email went out to the listserv, and it was, it came out publicly that he was dead.
I'm trying to think. I also have multiple people. I'm just trying to make sure I understand. It seems that Ima Shalom seems to know that her husband may try and pray for the death of her brother.
At home. Well, not directly.
But
he's not talking. He's expressing.
I'm talking. Right. But even so, that by expressing grief, that grief is so powerful that she has a sense.
Yes.
She knows that an expression of grief that powerful can go.
Because she knows her brother did not.
Right, and that is powerful enough to actually bring death upon her brother.
Yes.
This seems to be kind of connected, and I don't know if I'm brought it with the mob, right? She knows the power of prayer. And so, therefore, she's trying to prevent something, or she's trying to
absolutely. I like that.
Something.
Yes.
Okay. Now I understand. Mm-hmm. I'm really
that. Great. Yeah.
But it also appears that she hovers over him.
Yeah, she won't let him alone.
She wants to make sure.
Get up, get up. Right.
She wants to make sure that he's not falling in the state.
Why didn't she just tell him?
So that, and it's only because she either misunderstood the Jewish mother. Or if something else happened. Otherwise, she's right there watching him almost every single moment.
Right. Isn't it interesting?
There's something else.
She has to be right there. But she loves her brother, too. Right? By the way, just to point out, I don't know if you remember the story well, because I didn't give you the whole story of Tadosh Halach Nai. To further, in my head, part of the reason why I believe that Eliezer is not fully cognizant is also, like, he gets up from being excommunicated and a third of the props die. Right? Even the dough in their hands. And then, like, I don't know, he's got little zot vision that burns things on impact. And it doesn't feel active. It feels like it's being done for him. So I think that if you read it I mean, that's an opinion. I think it's an opinion. My opinion is that he's not he's not really actively doing it, but that it's God apparently getting, you know, having his back. Yeah.
His pain reverberates in the world.
I think so.
It causes the current of the ocean to shift. It causes giant waves.
Right.
I think that's part of the point of the story. It is what effect causing someone pain can have in the universe.
Uh-huh. Which is why I think it's crazy not to have this whole piece. Because to me, the Ona'a is the key, right, to the whole thing. Obviously, you know, we like taking things out of context. It's a Jewish thing. Certainly a Midrashic thing. Okay, so if it's okay, I'd like to move on. It looks like 10 seconds I have. So the next source here is a source about Miriam, some of you might be familiar with. Somebody want to read?
Vayelech ish b'beit Levi, leichan halach, amar rav Yehuda bar Zvina, shalach ba'atzat bito. Tana, Amram gedok ador haya, kevan shera'a sha'amar, or shegazar paro ha'rasha, kol haben ha'yilot ha'yaorik ishlechuhu, amar, lashav anu amelim, amar v'gireshet ishto.
All right, stop. So basically what happened so far, by the way, there is another version of this in Shemot Rabbah, probably even another one. Shemot Rabbah is slightly different, so I chose this one on purpose, you'll see in a second. Well, I'll explain in a second. So far, we learned a few interesting things. It turns out Amram was the greatest man of his generation. The funnier version, Shemot Rabbah, actually has him the head of the Sanhedrin. I like a good anachronism, don't you? I like this one a little bit better, it's a little cleaner. Right? He's the greatest man of his generation, because of course Moshe doesn't come from, you know, crappy stock. Right? Just come on, meet him up. And so he's the greatest of his generation. He feels really, like, hopeless. Right? When Paro makes this decree, and he's like, well, what are we working for? We're working for our children. If we can't keep our children, then I don't see the point. And you can hear that desperation and sadness. I'm just going to divorce my wife because I don't want to have to kill my own children. And what could be worse? And because he's such an important character, then everybody else divorces their wives as well. Okay, go ahead.
Amdu chulam to Yeshua de Shotayim. Amra lo bito abba. Kasher gezeratcha yoter mishol paro. Sheparo lo gazar ela ala zecharim. Vata gazata ala zecharim ala zekibot. Paro lo gazar ela bolav hazeh. Vata bolav hazeh lo haba. Paro harasha. Safek mitkayemet gezerato. Safek ino mitkayemet. Ata tzadik bevadai shegezeratcha mitkayemet. Shenemar. Vatigzor Omar Vayakam Lach Amad Vehzeret Ishto Amdu Chulan Vehzeret Meshotei.
Okay, so basically, and some of this you may be familiar, this line should be familiar to you from that holiday we just had. What's that? Is that again? Yes, what's the context for
that? Yes, they were trying to show Laban, I think, is worse than
Aramiel Ben Avi. So, in the context of Aramiel Ben Avi, they're actually trying to vilify Laban, which is already strange. Because, like, really? Where we have this section that says Laban was so awful because he tried to gazar and he tried to decree against all people, because if he destroys Jacob, then we're all dead. Right? And that's right. Some would argue that the original form of this would be this. Please see our teacher, Vizotsky, Rabbi Dr. Vizotsky, for more information on that. For right now, I'm going to focus here on Miriam as this deliverer of information. She said, listen, only the boys are decreed to die. So by virtue of the fact that you are willing to divorce all, you know, the wives, you know, you've divorced your wife and my mom, right? And therefore, they're all doing it as well. There are all these women that aren't going to be born. What if one of those women, there is a version, by the way, that does say, what if one of these women is going to be the deliverer? How do you know? Like, what are you thinking? And he says, I think she goes further, she says, not only that, but you're a righteous person. Your decree will actually be fulfilled. Meaning, there will be no children. Because you're righteous, everyone listens to you. And there will be no children. You want to stop the next generation? Is this really what you want? Right? And he realizes that she's right. He gets up, he takes his wife back,
They get up, they all take their wives back. In the version of Shmuel Rabbah, I do like this piece better. I think he kisses her on the head. Actually, the first part is interesting. But I don't know if it's the Shmuel Rabbah version or it's a different one. But there's one version where he starts, she announces something and he hits her. Right? And then she says, and then she explains why it is that she get remarried, and he kisses her. It's like a very physical, like, and, you know, sort of a parallel piece. It's very interesting. So I suggest you look at that at some point. Just kind of interesting. Also, is that...
That's Shmuel Rabbah. I'm pretty sure that one is Shmuel Rabbah. What?
The original.
I think so.
Okay.
Also, the weird Sanhedrin piece.
Yeah.
I don't think so. Yeah.
Is this story complementary or a different take on the story of the mirrors in the orchard?
Explain.
So the mirrors that the women use to seduce, like, is this a Devar affair? Is this something else? Or do they complement each other? I'm just curious if they're...
I don't know how to answer that. You know, I like my personal view of Midrash for the most part is one I got from a professor here named Mandel, who was visiting from Israel, and you remember, plus, right? And he viewed it as index cards. I mean, it's Midrashim, and they're all index cards, and they get like taken out and put in like context, which I think is a beautiful notion, and it makes absolute sense because what happens is how you frame the index card changes the Midrash drastically and crazily, which is like, it just shows you the power of literature, good literature, and the power of framing anything, really. And I think it's an absolutely, really true way to learn Midrash. But it still makes us really curious to know which is the original.
Yeah.
Like, we still want to figure out, regardless, we still want to know where the first index card was. So I can't answer that question right now. You know, without a sort of a deeper study of it. But it's a good question. Okay. At any rate, Miriam gives us wisdom. Miriam, who obviously now, in theory, you think you listen to her. I mean, she is the one who actually saved Moshe, but she hasn't done it yet. Right? So she hasn't really proven herself yet. Right? And so she's just this kid, and she's a girl. And, you know, you're just as late like the rest of us, right? And you wouldn't think she's other, but she is other, because she's the one who actually tries to explain that, yeah, I know you don't want to lose a child, I get it. Like, I know, but there are girls, and you're killing the whole, you know, community.
She's a minor, a slave.
She's a minor, she's a slave, she's everything the rabbis had put aside. That's good, yeah. Very good. Yeah. All right. Good. All right. So in the next one, right? The next one is, I think, a very unusual. I mean, you knew that I was going to have to bring Afer in here at some point. This is Elisha ben Abuya. I just think this is an interesting source because he was already other, literally other. Those of you who have some experience with Elisha ben Abuya, he's our apostate, I guess. He's our four people go into Pardes. Akiva's the only one that comes out whole. One dies, one goes crazy. And this guy cuts shoots. He's a gardener. He's a gardener. I don't know what I mean. Cuts shoots, understood by most people to understand that he has left Judaism for maybe other learning. We don't really, really know what that means. And there are, of course, other origin stories for why Acher ends up becoming a heretic, which isn't important right now, but let's look at this text. Somebody want to read this one?
After his apostasy, Acher, Elisha ben Abuya, asked Rebbe Meir, what is the meaning of the verse, golden glass cannot equal it, neither shall the exchange thereof be vessels of fine gold? He answered, these are the words of the Torah, which are hard to acquire like vessels of fine gold, but are easily destroyed like vessels of glass.
Okay, so aside, forget about the drop for a second. The most interesting thing to me, of course, is...
that he goes to
service. Having a conversation. And they're still schmoozing. He's his teacher. Right? Elisha ben Abuya is still, like, you know, hanging out with Rabbi Meir, or I don't know if he's hanging out, or in various other versions, if you've looked at these sort of this series of stories, a lot of which actually appear in the same place, it may be that actually Meir keeps coming back to him, and not the other way around.
Well, doesn't
they're talking Torah. I mean, who initiated it? Acher, he's the one who says, hey, how do you learn this verse? Hey, maybe his motives aren't exactly clear, right? He's not exactly, you know, just, oh, I'm just curious. I really want to know this Torah bird. He seems to be setting him up, right? Oh, so a mayor answers. He's like, oh, this is what it means, you know. They can be destroyed easily. Yeah, go ahead, said Acher to him,
Rabbi Akiva, your master did not explain to us, but as follows, just as vessels of gold and vessels of glass, though they be broken, has a remedy. Even so, a scholar, though he has sinned, has a remedy. Thereupon Rabbi Meir said to him, then you too repent. He replied, I have already heard from behind the veil. Return your wayward, backsliding children, except prophets.
What? So it appears. Acher set him up. So what does this verse mean? Because he already knows how Rabbi Akiva is, buddy. Right? How Rabbi Akiva is going to explain it. And he says, no, that's not what it means. I'll tell you what it means. It means everyone, everything, even broken things can be fixed. I'm broken. Don't you think I'm broken? I should be able to be fixed. He's setting him up. So Mayor says, oh, great. My teacher, you can come back. Repent. Do tshuva and come back to us. Oh, sorry, I can't. Why? What? Turns out everyone can be fixed except for me. Wait, how did you learn that exactly? From an affair. You say Acharei Pargod, right? So we have this notion, this you know, things that are learned from behind the veil. Of course, what's on the other side of the veil? Heavenly something, not us, right? We are on this side of the veil. Where we are not is the other side of the veil. Where we do not usually hear is things on the other side of the veil. We are other to them, and they are other to us. We do not. We're not supposed to learn things from Acharei Pargod. When we do learn them, that's actually interesting by itself. The fact that the person who actually got to hear it was Acher is incredibly interesting. Why is the Acher the only one who's allowed to hear what the Acharim are saying? Right?
He may be wrong.
What? Do you think he lied?
No. He is delivering a message of Hesed, actually.
Yeah.
That he can't make tshuva.
Right?
That only he's stubbornly attached to his contrariness and to his unwillingness to
be honest. Why are you putting the onus on him?
No, well,
why did you put all the onus on him? God accepts everybody. You think nobody else is stubborn?
No,
dude. It's not a criticism. I think he is genuinely proudly attached to it because he's kind of mafis here, as you said.
But to say it is to make it so. Right? The message from Acharei Pargod is everyone can do tshuva, but this guy can't do tshuva. It sort of reminds you of the Ben Sora Mora, which I thought the rabbis tried to get rid of, sort of, right? I mean, the bottom line is to imply that there is no ease, there is no tshuva for this individual is a damning, right, you know, state to be in.
What's so strange is every other story brought, the stranger has counteracted a message of despair of some sort. And this one suits me.
If you have to read the rest, I wrote a lot of this, actually. There's a lot, tons of stuff on this.
Yep.
But the he's not lying. I mean, it's clear it's true. That
no.
The underlying message may be doing something else. Not just, his despair is there for one for a reason.
Yeah.
His other despair. But his stubbornness and brand, he really has to
explain.
Yeah, right. I mean, that's true.
And we do actually occasionally learn other things from Acharei Pargod. It's also a motif. By the way, the other famous example of somebody who says actually learns the same message from Acharei Pargod is Jesus, who also learns and also quotes back at his student. His teacher, actually. That I would come back, but it turns out I can't come back because
there's something in the
Avodah Zarah right now. So, it's in the part that I cut 7b or whatever it is. Yeah.
I think is there anything else to think about is if what he heard from the curtain was, you know, so when it puts me off hair, is as long as he's off hair, he can't make tshuva. But if you're not going to make tshuva, he would no longer be off hair, so it wouldn't actually be invalidated.
All right, so you're fixing. It's nice. No, I like
so, it. But what's that going to mean? Because if Elisha Ben Ahuya can make tshuva, off hair can't.
Okay. I see what you're saying.
This is the one that starts with the he's riding on the...
Yeah, it's in the same section. Mm-hmm. And the braids on fire. Also, after the other... I think it's after.
And like that's where you're going to label
the radish.
Radish.
It's all a little section.
But I would say there's a stubborn affection for the opera because he clearly, I mean, I don't know if it's the last thing he does, is he's going out of Kuhn and he tells Reverend Mayer to go back. He clearly cares and knows the value of staying in the community because he tells his friend who he cares about, or even, you know, that you have to go back. I can't go back, but you have to.
Right.
Right, you don't want this kind
of... Where they repeat this again, by the way. They repeat the line, I think, again.
Yeah. But he knows that the ultimate insult is to be outside, right? That's why they call him Acher. That's why they choose that name, is because he's another. He's not in the community.
Right, he's even calling himself Acher, which is interesting. Right. Yeah, absolutely. I think that is an interesting thing. Okay, so we have to actually end, so that's when I'm like, tie it, you know, together. And that is, you know, I just want to point out, right, this is another example. However you see the personality of Acher here, he is still teaching Mayer something. Mayer believed that everyone can do tshuva, and he was so excited. Just for a second, right? And he can have his teacher back. Sorry, no, not everybody can. Some people are outside, whether it's by will or whether it's not, right? He cannot do tshuva. He cannot go back to that community. He cannot be part of that community again. And that's the wisdom that he actually has to impart. The irony of which, of course, at the end, I just want to point your attention to at some point to look at this piece from Soloveitchik, which I think was interesting. It's talking about, like, where does redemption come from as a concept? Redemption involves movement by an individual or community from the periphery of history to its center. In order to be redeemed, whatever redemption means, it has to be a movement of either a person or a group or whatever it is from the periphery to the center, from the outside in. Which I sort of want to draw your attention to because I think that's a lot of what we're talking about. Now, obviously, the author one's sort of a bummer to end on because it's not really redemption in a sense unless you're like, you know, maybe he's free. You know what? Maybe you can look at it a different way. Maybe he's pretty okay pulling radishes on Shabbat. Unless if that was the worst. Right? But that the idea is actually very interesting. I just want to point your attention to, I think it's interesting what Soloveitchik says, is that the implication is that the slaves, kind of like to bring it back to Vassanos, the slaves have no voice at all, and Moshe, who comes from the outside, who wasn't himself a slave, is the only one who would actually provide voice to the slaves, and without him being the other, he's ironically the other there, who brings the slaves, who gives them voice, who finally has God actually hear them and frees them. I know that's exactly what I'm trying to say, but go with it. And so I just think it's an interesting thing. I hope, you know, you'll see that it actually repeats a lot in all kinds of literature, certainly literature of our rabbis, but also I think movies and TV and everything else.
Thank you.
Thank you.